KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I got to play that in April, and that was the most thrilling game experience I've had in a long time. So I can't wait to experience that from the comfort of my home with my friends or enemies.
Fans around the world can now get their hands on the long-awaited Nintendo Switch 2 video game console.
It's Thursday, June 5th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. President Trump's tariffs are beginning to raise some real money for the federal government.
Forecasters say it could put a dent in the federal deficit, but there are caveats.
It's not revenue that the government can really rely on, particularly when the president is aiming to use it as a bargaining chip.
And after outages at the Newark airport, the transportation secretary wants Congress to fund a new air traffic control system.
At its core, it's a money problem where the FAA's been asked to do more with less, essentially.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President Trump and Chinese leader Xi Jinping spoke by phone today, and as NPR's Mara Liasson reports, the call comes amid an escalating trade war between the two countries.
Trump told reporters the call, which lasted an hour and a half, went very well. He also posted on social media that the call resulted in a, quote, very positive conclusion for both countries. That conclusion appears to be an agreement to resume in-person talks between Chinese officials and the U.S. Treasury Secretary, Commerce Secretary, and Trade Representative. Last month, the two countries had agreed to temporarily lower their mutual tariffs, but then the Trump administration accused China of violating that agreement by holding back imports of rare earth minerals, which are critical to the U.S. auto industry. And China accused the U.S. of preventing it from buying computer chips for artificial intelligence and of revoking the visas without cause for Chinese citizens studying in the U.S. Mara Liasson, NPR News.
President Trump is threatening to end billions of dollars in contracts and subsidies given to Elon Musk's companies. As NPR's Bobby Allen reports, this amid a growing feud between Trump and the world's richest man.
President Trump says ending federal support to Musk's companies would be the easiest way to save government money. Musk's business empire is backed by billions of dollars in government contracts, tax breaks, and other support. Much of the federal money flowing to Musk's companies supports SpaceX through Department of Defense contracts. In response, Musk wrote that SpaceX will begin decommissioning its Dragon spacecraft, which delivers U.S. astronauts to the International Space Station and brings them home. Musk's tensions with Trump escalated when the president said Musk disliked Trump's signature tax and spending bill because it ended electric vehicle tax credits. Musk replied that it is unfair EV solar incentives would be slashed with no cuts to oil and gas subsidies. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
A federal judge says AmeriCorps has to restore its programs in 24 states after the Trump administration gutted them. But as NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports, the decision is only a partial victory for the service agency.
The judge agreed with two dozen Democratic-led states that AmeriCorps did not follow proper procedure in dismantling its programs. The agency ended grants and abruptly fired tens of thousands of mostly young service members who work in schools, national parks, and communities hit by disaster. Programs in the states that sued could now be restarted, but the judge declined to block the firing of about 85% of AmeriCorps staff. She said it was too speculative to argue that the agency could not function without those jobs, and she said states made an unfounded assumption that those employees could return smoothly to the jobs they held before. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
U.S. futures contracts are trading in mixed territory. You're listening to NPR News. The Italian government has passed a controversial law that cracks down on forms of even peaceful protest while giving significantly more power to security forces. NPR's Ruth Sherlock has more.
During the vote in Italy's Senate, the session was temporarily suspended as opposition lawmakers staged a protest on the chamber floor, shouting the word shame repeatedly. The decree proposed by Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni brings harsher punishments for acts like passive resistance in prisons and migrant detention centres. It criminalises public protest actions like the blocking of roads and allows for the imprisonment of convicted pregnant women or those with babies. Amnesty International has called it draconian, and protests across Italy have taken place against the decree in recent months. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
Consumer goods company Procter & Gamble says it's cutting up to 7,000 jobs, about 6% of its workforce, over the next 2 years, part of a restructuring program, as the consumer goods giant says it's trying to navigate higher tariffs and slower growth. P&G, which owns Pampers, Tide, and Swiffer, also says it plans to slim down on the corporate side. The Nintendo Switch 2 is finally in the store, 8 years after the initial release of the Japanese video game maker's popular video game console. Even with a hefty $450 price tag, fans around the world lined up outside stores to pick up pre-orders or have the chance to buy the device. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. This is NPR.
On a Thursday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Today was an opinion release day at the U.S. Supreme Court, and the justices issued several important decisions. They include rulings on guns, employment discrimination in a case brought by a straight person, and a tax exemption that was denied to a Catholic charity. For more, we're joined in studio by NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Hi there.
Hi there, Juana.
So, Nina, give us your takeaway from the cases that were decided today.
Well, it's June, and the justices are now stepping on the gas as they move towards, hopefully anyway, ending the term on time at the end of this month. All of today's decisions were unanimous, proving that the court isn't always split, and proving, too, that liberals can and do rule for religion, for gun manufacturers, and for a straight woman claiming that she was discriminated against because of her straightness.
Okay, so let's start there with this discrimination case. Tell us what the court did.
This is what's classically called a reverse discrimination case involving an Ohio woman who claims that she didn't get a job and then was demoted because she's straight. And then her replacements both times were gay or lesbian. The Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals tossed her case out at an early stage because she didn't meet the higher bar that the appeals court required in discrimination cases involving members of a majority group. But today, the Supreme Court rejected that higher bar, and writing for the court, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson pointed to the text of the federal employment discrimination law. She said that by establishing the same protections for every individual, Congress left no room for courts to impose special requirements on majority group plaintiffs.
Okay, let's turn now to the gun lawsuit, which was brought by the government of Mexico against seven American gun manufacturers for allegedly aiding and abetting an illegal invasion of guns from the U.S. into Mexico. What were the arguments?
Well, Justice Elena Kagan wrote the court's decision, deftly explaining the difference between the problem and the law. Mexico, as she pointed out, has a severe gun problem, which its government views as coming from north of the border. The country has only a single gun store and issues fewer than 50 gun permits a year, but gun traffickers can purchase firearms in the United States, often illegally and in bulk, and deliver them to drug cartels in Mexico, where they're used to kill, kidnap, and commit drug crimes. The Mexican government's lawsuit, which sought billions of dollars in damages, alleged that the U.S. gun manufacturers failed to exercise reasonable care to prevent this gun trafficking, which they knew was going on.
But Nina, I understand that the court did not buy that argument. Why not?
As Kagan said in court today, the Mexican government might have a good theory, but for the fact that U.S. cities brought similar suits in the early 2000s and Congress promptly passed a law shielding gun manufacturers from lawsuits stemming from the criminal use of a firearm by a third party. Now, the law does have an exception for cases in which a manufacturer or seller knows knowingly aids and abets criminal sales. And Mexico claims that's what U.S. manufacturers do, that they know who the bad apple dealers are and still do business with them to boost profits. But Kagan said Mexico's complaint does not plausibly allege the kind of conscious and culpable participation in another's wrongdoing needed to prove liability. We have little doubt, she said, that some of these sales take place, but the Mexican government has not sufficiently alleged that the gun makers not only participate in illegal gun sales, but also want them to happen, which she said is what the law requires.
Nina, we'll end with the Catholic Charities case. Tell us about it.
The court ruled that the state of Wisconsin violated the Constitution when it refused to give Catholic Charities the same exemption it gives to churches, exempting them from having to pay the state's unemployment tax. The state had maintained that the Catholic charity did not qualify for the exemption because it's not a proselytizing entity. But writing for the court today, Justice Sonia Sotomayor said, quote, It's fundamental to our constitutional order that the government maintain neutrality between religion and religion. There may be hard calls to make in policing that rule, she acknowledged, but this is not one of them.
NPR's Nina Totenberg, thank you.
Thank you.
The fragile state of the U.S. air traffic control system became glaringly obvious during a series of recent outages affecting passenger jets operating around the airport in Newark, New Jersey. Now, the transportation secretary is pushing Congress to allocate tens of billions of dollars for a brand new air traffic control system. Cost is just one of the obstacles, as NPR's Joel Rose reports.
Walking into many of the nation's air traffic control towers is like stepping back in time.
The information was put on flight progress strips that indicate the flight number, route, altitude.
This newsreel from the 1960s shows how air traffic controllers used paper flight strips to keep track of planes.
These strips were distributed to all controllers in the Chicago Center who would be controlling the flight.
More than half a century later, air traffic controllers across the U.S. are still using paper strips. Many computer and telecom systems date back to the 1980s and 90s, depending on floppy disks and computers running on Windows 95. The Federal Aviation Administration found in 2023 that more than a third of the nation's air traffic control systems are unsustainable, and some are starting to fail, as we saw during the recent radar and communication outages that led to hundreds of delays and cancellations at Newark Liberty International Airport.
This is the most important infrastructure project that we've had in this country for decades. Everyone agrees this is nonpartisan. Everyone knows we have to do it.
Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy wants a brand new air traffic control system, and he has broad backing across the aviation industry, from the union that represents air traffic controllers to trade groups for airlines and manufacturers. They've all signed on to a coalition called Modern Skies, which produced this TV ad leaning heavily on 1980s nostalgia with leg warmers and portable cassette players.
That was then. But four decades later, floppy disks are still being used to run our air traffic control system.
It's easy to joke about outdated equipment, but it will be a lot harder to make up for decades of underinvestment and failed attempts to modernize the system. Michael Huerta is a former head of the FAA under President Obama. He also chaired a safety review team that looked at the air traffic control system 2 years ago.
At its core, it's a money problem where the FAA's been asked to do more with less, essentially.
The Trump administration has not said how much a brand new air traffic system will cost, though Secretary Duffy estimates it's in the tens of billions of dollars, and he's aiming to complete it within 4 years. This week, the Transportation Department asked private companies for their ideas on how to pull that off.
It's an extraordinarily ambitious plan.
David Grizzle is a former chief operating officer at the FAA. He's encouraged to see that the Trump administration is looking outside of government for help. But Grizzle also sees some possible obstacles. The FAA has spent a lot of money on upgrades before, Grizzle says, but it hasn't always seen a big payoff.
The FAA has not been allowed to shut down old, ancient equipment. Even the money that they have for equipment, more than 90% goes to fund old equipment.
There are other potential roadblocks, too. A big question is what to do about the air traffic control facilities that manage high-altitude traffic. Currently, there are 21 of them, many old and falling apart. The DOT has proposed building only 6 new ones, leaving it unclear what would happen to the others. Former FAA Administrator Michael Huerta says consolidation makes a lot of sense.
We probably don't need the number of facilities which were built at a time when technology was very different. We can get by with a smaller number.
Though Huerta says the politics of consolidation will be brutal. For now, the industry is focused on the first obstacle, finding enough money to bring the air traffic control system into the 21st century. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
The Nintendo Switch 2 is finally out. It's a sequel to one of the most popular video game consoles of all time. NPR's James Mastromarino reports on why Nintendo fans are racing to buy the new one.
Fans lined up for days in front of Nintendo's flagship New York City store to be the first buyers for the new Switch 2. Last night, they amped each other up by singing to a Mario tune. NPR's Alex Chung attended the midnight release at Nintendo New York, where he spoke to the influencer, JC Adler.
Yeah, I really love the new design of it. I like the features that you can play with friends, too, and the ability to not just have a gaming be a solo experience.
Adler acknowledged that at $450, the Switch 2 isn't cheap, but she thinks Nintendo's games justify the price tag.
The games speak for themselves, and people put a lot of effort into the games, so it makes sense. I still buy them.
Celebrities like Saturday Night Live's Bowen Yang also attended the event and played the new headlining game Mario Kart World. He's still excited for it after losing a race.
That was the perfect amuse-bouche for what will surely be a thrilling time in the knockout rounds. So I can't wait to experience that from the comfort of my home with my friends or enemies.
The Switch 2 is selling out at retailers across the country. Even after tariffs prompted Nintendo to delay Switch 2 pre-orders and raise prices on some console accessories.
This is a company that's over a century old, that lived through all the world wars. They know how to accommodate this kind of turmoil.
That's Joost van Drenen, professor at NYU's Stern School of Business. While he says Nintendo will eventually meet demand for the Switch 2, he thinks the company will need to do more to convince many gamers like himself to upgrade.
How do we communicate that this is a new device, that this is worth the $450? I'm happy to wait a little bit to get the Switch 2 because I'm already in that universe anyway, so I'll get it when I'm ready for it.
Nintendo projects to sell 15 million Switch 2 consoles by March of next year. But it remains to be seen whether the Switch 2 will come close to the 150 million units that the original Switch sold. James Mastromarino, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. From Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. A UN-backed report on hunger warns that 500,000 people in Gaza are facing starvation due to Israel's expanding war and its restrictions on aid. Experts describe this level of hunger as catastrophic and where famine can set in. NPR's Anas Baba in Gaza met with one of these families that is running out of ways to cope. NPR's Aya Batrawi in Dubai brings us this report.
That's Hassan Al-Zanin, 5 years old. He's the youngest of eight kids in the family and the only boy. He's spoiled with love and makes his older sisters laugh. The matriarch of this family is 39-year-old Mahassan Al-Zanin. She tells Hassan he shouldn't keep talking about how hungry he feels. Her husband, a school principal, died from COVID-19 in 2021. It was hard then, but she had a roof over her head and work. She trained teachers and once ran in local elections as an independent, one of the first women in Gaza to do so. She describes herself like this. As a burning candle that lights the way for others. NPR's producer Anas Baba met Al-Zanin, who also goes by Umma Hassan, and her children in their tent in Gaza City. They introduced themselves.
Hassan.
Rana.
Ruba.
Aya.
Asil. Hala.
Ragad.
Batul.
Hassan.
They've been displaced 10 times in nearly 20 months of war. Their home in the north is a pile of rubble, destroyed in an Israeli airstrike. Even in their tent now, an Israeli drone buzzes overhead, and Israeli tank shelling is heard in the distance. To feed her eight kids, Al-Zanin has leaned on friends and relatives for money, but they too are struggling to survive. So about a month ago, she turned to her 70-year-old mother. She gave Al-Zanin her gold wedding band to sell. It bought them food to last a few days. Markets have dried up and aid warehouses are empty after what had been weeks of Israeli blockade. Despite some UN aid that's entered in recent weeks, no food has reached Gaza City. It's been taken off trucks by hungry crowds in other parts of Gaza. A UN-backed report by dozens of experts says one in five people in Gaza now face catastrophic hunger and the territory is at risk of famine. And Zanin says her family is starving. She says they resorted to eating the leaves of berries and trees. She laughs at how maddening it is, but says it's the reality. Between the rows of makeshift tents in Gaza City where the family lives, her daughters grow basil in the dirt. Sometimes charities pass by, handing out bread. They wrap the basil in it. Her daughters feel dizzied. They faint. One daughter lost teeth because she doesn't have enough calcium. Her eldest daughter, Rana, a 20-year-old medical student before the war, weighs under 90 pounds. Rana's role in the family last year was getting bread from overcrowded bakeries where she saw a woman and two girls crushed to death in a crowd. She says it was famine then, but not like this. Now there aren't even bakeries. Hunger is ravaging the family. Al-Zanin says hunger is grief. It is loss of control. It's all-consuming, she says. The family wakes up and goes to sleep hungry. When lunch is available, they eat lentils, boiled plain and provided by a charity kitchen and many have shut down because they've run out of food. Israel says its aid restrictions are aimed at pressuring Hamas, which still holds Israeli hostages. Israel's new aid distribution system, run by American contractors, has been chaotic and plagued by deadly shootings. Al-Zanin says her little boy worries about dying of hunger. He wants eggs and milk. She takes him to the market to show him there is none. And on days when there's not even lentils, she says her girls just drink water from a truck that comes by the tents every morning. Water for breakfast, lentils for lunch, some days, water for dinner. This, she says, is their life. Aya Batraoui, NPR News Dubai, with Anas Baba in Gaza City.
President Trump's tariffs are starting to raise real money for the federal government. If that keeps up, forecasters say it could put a meaningful dent in the federal debt. Emphasis on could, because that forecast comes with a number of caveats. NPR's Scott Horsley is here to explain. Hey there.
Good afternoon.
How much money are Trump's new tariffs bringing in for the government?
Treasury data show that as of Tuesday, tariffs had raised close to $70 billion for the government so far this year, a lot of that just in the last couple of months since early April when the president started taxing nearly everything we import. Even here in Washington, $70 billion is real money, yeah. And it's a real break from recent history, according to Shai Akabas, who's been tracking the tariff revenue at the Bipartisan Policy Center.
Historically, tariffs have made up a very small portion of the revenue that the federal government brings in on an annual basis. Last year, tariffs were roughly 2% of overall government revenue.
Tariffs are on track to at least double that this year, and the White House is trumpeting a forecast from the Congressional Budget Office that says tariffs could shave $2.8 trillion off the federal debt over the next decade, which would roughly offset the cost of the big House-passed budget bill if the tariffs in effect earlier this week remain in place for 10 years. However, that is a big if.
The if is doing a lot of work. And why? What could change in that outlook?
Well, there are legal challenges that could undo a lot of these tariffs. Congress might get involved at some point. And Trump himself keeps changing the tariffs from week to week, sometimes day to day. So Adam Hirsch of the Economic Policy Institute says it would be unwise to expect the tariff picture is going to just hold steady for 10 full years.
It's not a source of revenue that the government can really rely on, particularly when the president is aiming to use it as a bargaining chip. They could go away the moment that the president decides to cut a deal or just to walk back on his threats.
And keep in mind, all this money the government's collecting in tariffs, it's not just falling out of the sky or coming from foreign countries. It's mostly being paid by American businesses and American families, and there will likely be some economic fallout from that.
We'll stay with that point for a second. What kind of economic fallout?
Well, the CBO projects these tariffs will lead to higher inflation and slower economic growth. I talked today with a wine importer in Columbus, Ohio, Patrick Allen. He would typically be ordering wine from France this time of year to sell during the fall and through the holidays. But he says a lot of those orders are on hold right now because he doesn't know if the tariff's going to be 10% or 20% or 50%.
We're going to be out of stuff on the shelves. But the thing is, all of those out of stocks on the shelves represent the money that we would have been making that we won't be making. Importers are afraid. They don't know when the other shoe is going to drop.
You can look at these tariffs as a $2.8 trillion tax on the economy that's been imposed entirely by the president.
And NPR's Scott Horsley, thanks as ever for your reporting.
You're welcome.
It's NPR News.
Morning Edition takes you across this country and around the world with stories that keep you informed and the context to understand what matters. The news comes at you quickly, but we slow it down to examine each story from different angles and give perspective on what might happen next. A brand new day comes with new possibilities and a new edition of Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Our series, Here to Help, spotlights volunteers going above and beyond.
Today, a volunteer with Habitat for Humanity Austin working to build homes for others.
We laughed at each other because we made so many mistakes, and but, you know, we built a beautiful home.
That story's ahead. First News.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. President Trump has issued a proclamation banning foreign students from entering the U.S. to study at Harvard. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny tells us it's the latest escalation between the Ivy League school and the federal government.
Trump's new order cites national security concerns, including what it says are high crime rates and unchecked foreign influence on campus. In a statement, Trump said he was also directing Secretary of State Marco Rubio to begin revoking visas of foreign students at the Ivy League school. In a statement, Harvard called the move, quote, another retaliatory step that was in violation of the school's First Amendment rights. This is the second time the Trump administration has attempted to ban Harvard from enrolling international students. The previous attempt was temporarily blocked by a federal judge last month. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News.
Carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere have reached a new high for modern record keeping. NPR's Jeff Brady reports scientists at the Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii say that for the first time, CO2 levels have exceeded the global benchmark.
The concentration of carbon dioxide, or CO2, has steadily increased since the Industrial Revolution. Humans' burning of fossil fuels releases the greenhouse gas into the atmosphere. There, the CO2 acts like a blanket, warms the lower atmosphere, leading to more extreme heat waves, droughts, flooding, and wildfires. The Mauna Loa Observatory is considered the global benchmark for monitoring CO2 concentrations. Levels peak every year in May in the Northern Hemisphere before plants absorb CO2 during the summer growing season. The Scripps Institution of Oceanography says last month the concentration was 3.6 parts per million higher than a year ago. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
Well, shares of Tesla dropped on Wall Street as a public feud between CEO Elon Musk and President Trump heats up. This is NPR. American tennis star Coco Gauff has advanced to the final of the French Open, where she'll meet the top-ranked player from Belarus for the chance to win her second Grand Slam title, NPR's Becky Sullivan reports.
In the semifinal, Coco Gauff faced a crowd favorite in the French player Loïs Boisson, who is making a Cinderella run through the Open despite being ranked just 361st in the world. Gauff shut the door on Boisson's fairy tale ending by beating her in straight sets 6-1, 6-2. Her victory sets up a final between the top two players in the world, a first for the French Open in the past three decades. Aryna Sabalenka is number one after a stellar 2024 in which she won both the Australian Open and the U.S. Open. And Gauff is number two. Gauff hasn't won a Grand Slam since her thrilling U.S. Open victory 2 years ago, but the person she beat there was Sabalenka. The final will take place Saturday. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
The European Central Bank has cut its key interest rate for the eighth time in just over a year, while here in the U.S., the Federal Reserve has held rates steady since December, due in part to concerns that President Trump's tariffs war could push inflation higher again. The central bank has opted to hold off on lowering interest rates despite continued calls by Trump to slash those rates. Fed Chair Powell says the Fed is awaiting further data to guide its policy decision on whether to lower rates again this year. I'm Dwayne Brown. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peepshow's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. We don't want them. That's how President Trump unveiled sweeping new travel restrictions from the Oval Office on Wednesday. Starting Monday, citizens from 12 countries will be barred from entering the U.S. Tighter rules are coming for 7 other countries. Trump says it's about security vetting and visa overstays, citing the recent attack on a demonstration in Boulder, Colorado. The suspect in that attack is from Egypt, notably not on the list. We've turned to 3 of our international correspondents in Asia, Africa, and Latin America to find out how the travel ban is likely to affect countries it targets in those regions. First, Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Africa accounts for the lion's share of countries affected by Trump's new travel ban. 7 countries on the continent were hit with a total ban. The list is varied and includes democracies, authoritarian states, and war-torn nations. But Suren Pillay, director of the Center for African Studies at the University of Cape Town, said the list did raise questions.
Why this list? Why this particular group of countries? And of course, one imagines that the list could expand.
Pillay did see one common thread that unites the banned countries.
So there is clearly a racial character to these exclusions, to the calculation of who should be removed or discouraged from coming to the United States.
The reasons President Trump gave for the ban ranged from Eritrea refusing to accept back its nationals to Somalia acting as a, quote, terrorist safe haven, and conflict-stricken Sudan's lack of ability to issue travel documents. Mostly, though, the reason given was that many of the countries, including Chad and Togo, had high visa overstay rates. But statistics showed that out of all the countries banned, the African countries accounted for the lowest number of visas. Citizens of Sudan, for example, were granted just 833 non-immigrant visas in 2023. And Somalia had a 77% refusal rate for citizens applying for U.S. entry last year. Reaction in Africa to the bans was strong. The African Union called on the U.S. to, quote, use a balanced, evidence-based approach to deciding on who could enter the country. And Chad's president, Mohamed Deby, responded by slapping a ban on U.S. citizens wishing to travel to Chad. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
Refugees International didn't mince words. They said the travel ban against Haiti was, quote, racist. Yael Shaker, the director for the Americas, says the White House singled out the world's first black republic by saying Haitian immigrants who came in the past few years, quote, harm American communities.
You know, it was the only country where, like, the nationals of the country were actually discussed as opposed to just the security concerns around vetting.
Shaker says this is also just the latest punch against Haiti. Since Trump came into office, his administration has taken away humanitarian paroles from recent Haitian immigrants. And in August, he plans to end temporary protected status for Haitians, some of whom have been in the country for decades.
You know, like, it's heaping more and more on this population, which is one of the most vulnerable, like, if not most in need of legal pathways and protection to the United States. And doesn't have options.
Ever since President Jovenel Moise was assassinated in 2021, Haiti has spiraled toward anarchy. Gangs now control a majority of the capital city. Nearly half the population is going hungry.
We have a saying that c'est la caille, home is home. But there's no home to go to.
That's Cecile Axilien, who studies Haiti at the University of Maryland.
You have a country that is run by gangs. Where are people supposed to go?
Axilien says Haitians have been looking for hope for years now, and all they have found is a world that turns its back. This travel ban, for example, comes just as the neighboring Dominican Republic has enacted a mass deportation program of Haitians. So this new policy, says Axilien, feels especially cruel.
It's inhumane in whichever way you look at it, because it's not looking at the context of where Haiti is right now at this very moment.
Ada Peralta, NPR News, Mexico City.
This travel ban is just the latest move by the Trump administration to target Afghans in some way. One of Trump's first moves, hours after his inauguration, was to suspend the U.S. refugee admissions program, which halted the process for an estimated 200,000 Afghans. They were mostly the families of men and women who worked with the U.S. or related institutions, and Afghans who fought alongside American forces. The U.S. pulled all troops and personnel out of Afghanistan in the summer of 2021, after nearly two decades in the country, as the Taliban overran the capital, Kabul. Many Afghans waiting to be resettled in the U.S. are in Pakistan, but Pakistan has been forcing them back to their home country, even if it's a risk to their lives. The Trump administration has also cut most of America's promised aid to Afghanistan, including money that went to the World Food Program. That fed millions of hungry men, women, and children. The administration argued the Taliban was siphoning off the aid. Meanwhile, the Department of Homeland Security announced temporary protected status for Afghanistan would end this summer. And now Trump has issued this new executive order banning Afghans from entering the U.S., saying that Afghans are more likely to overstay their visas. There's an exception for Afghans meant to enter on a visa category for those who fought alongside American forces. The problem? The Trump administration is also dismantling the offices that handled their resettlement. Advocates for America's Afghan allies say the Trump administration's blows feel relentless. Like Sean Van Driver of Afghan Evac. He says, when you look at the sum of what the Trump administration is doing,
it is really just this administration, the cruelty is the point, it seems.
Dia Hadid, NPR News, Mumbai.
NPR contacted the White House for a response about the comments on race. White House spokesperson Abigail Jackson labeled the accusations of racism, quote, lazy, unfounded, and inaccurate, and said the bans were designed to keep Americans safe. When Ply Being Lick is hungry, there's not much that can stop him.
Being is an elephant, a 27-year-old elephant who lives in a national park northeast of Bangkok. Now, typically, wild elephants eat 300 pounds or more of grasses, shrubs, and fruit.
Being is no exception, but on Monday, it seems he was interested in diversifying his diet with a little treat.
Yeah, maybe he was having a hard day, or maybe he had just hit a big goal of some sort. Juana, does he really need a reason?
Absolutely not. Whatever his motivation, though, he headed out of the park and into town where he ducked his head through the door of a small grocery store. On video from the shop's cameras, he basically fills the shop. His back literally brushes the ceiling as he casually scans the inventory.
The shop owner, Komploy Kakyal, told CNN it had been kind of a slow day until Biang showed up. She says he walked up to the candy counter, gently pushed a freezer out of the way, and proceeded to eat about 10 bags of sweets, dried bananas, and peanut snacks.
After about 10 minutes, park rangers were able to coax Biang out of the store, and the whole thing is pretty incredible. Yes, sometimes human and elephant encounters can turn violent.
Yeah, but this one, honestly, Biang's shopping trip was almost elegant. No elephant was hurt. Damage to the shop was minimal. A wildlife protection group even offered to pay Biang's bill.
So next time you need a little treat, maybe be a little like Biang. But hey, don't forget your wallet. You're listening to All Things Considered. A new opera, which premiered this week in Chicago, highlights the lesser-known women who worked alongside Rosa Parks during the Civil Rights Movement. Reporter Courtney Kippers from member station WBEZ in Chicago has more.
When Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat to a white rider on a segregated bus, the world took notice. But as the new opera She Who Dared tells it, Parks was part of a larger movement that was taking hold in the late 1950s in Montgomery, Alabama. Here's librettist Deborah Deep Mouton, who wrote the story.
For me, this idea came out of my mother telling me that I had a cousin who sat on the bus before Rosa Parks. And at first, I just kind of thought she was making up things, but the more I dug into it, I actually found someone with her maiden name, Browder, Aurelia Browder, who did sit on the bus 5 months before Rosa Parks.
Browder was also arrested. Mouton and composer Jasmine Ariel Barnes are believed to be the first team of Black women to write a professionally staged opera. She Who Dared tells the story of seven women who laid the groundwork for the Montgomery bus boycott. The activists' efforts eventually changed history. Over time, that history has really zeroed in on Parks. She's part of this opera too, but in a way that reveals more of the story. She did not stay seated because she was frail or tired, says Barnes.
The reality was she trained for it. It was planned. She knew exactly when she was going to do it. She knew the bus driver.
Yet the opera humanizes a moment of doubt Parks has before she boards the bus. That moment fuels an aria, sung by Jacqueline Eccles McCarley as Parks. She's wondering, will this even matter?
When they ask me, when they ask me to stand, will I save it?
Lawrence Edelson is the head of the Chicago Opera Theater. For him, the aria also underscores that Barnes and Mouton are making their own history with this show.
I will put that aria up with something by Puccini or by Mozart or by Verdi in terms of the emotional punch and the melodic beauty. It is just stunning.
When Barnes and Mouton began working on the show in 2022, they could not have foreseen the world it would premiere in, one in which diversity initiatives are being scrubbed and public arts funding is facing cuts. Here's Mouton.
I think that we always knew the work we were doing was important, but there's like this incendiary nature to the work now that I didn't expect, where now this push for equality and this push for listen to us and we have value feels more like a rallying cry than it does a commentary on the past.
She Who Dared runs through Sunday at Chicago's Studebaker Theater. For NPR News, I'm Courtney Kippers in Chicago.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. One of baseball's most hallowed achievements could be within reach this year. New York Yankees slugger Aaron Judge is flirting with the magical, elusive batting average 400. Now, he does have impressive stats so far this season, but it has been the better part of a century since a ballplayer has reached that number. Steve Futterman explains just why 400 is so difficult.
When the Yankees came to Los Angeles last week to play the Dodgers, one player clearly stood out.
Right fielder, number 99, Aaron Judge.
Judge, 6'7" and 280 pounds, towers above everyone in the batter's box. Breaking barriers is nothing new for him, as heard here on the Yankees radio network.
Swung on. There it goes. Deep left, it is high. It is far. It is gone. Number 62 to set the...
In 2022, Judge set the American League record for the most home runs in a season. Pretty remarkable stuff. But when you mention hitting 400, that's something altogether different. No one has done it since 1941.
Coming up for the second time at bat, Ted Williams, hitting 405.
Ted Williams ended that season at 406 for the Boston Red Sox. In the 84 years since then, no one else has done it. So why do people think Aaron Judge might have a chance this season?
The greatness of Judgey is that, you know, he never stops trying to get better.
That's the Yankees hitting coach Jim Rawson.
This is a guy who's at the top of our game. If the book ended right now, it's a Hall of Fame book, but yet we're not even close. He's still writing the story.
They first worked together in 2014 when Judge was just a rookie. This is Judge's 10th season and maybe his best, hitting for both power and average as he flirts with 400.
If he does this, I mean, it's going to be astronomical numbers, right? But I wouldn't put it past him. There's nothing that I wouldn't say, hey, this guy can't do. I don't think he's striving for necessarily 400, but I think he's striving every day to be the best hitter that he can be. And that hitter can definitely do it. It's possible.
In the first 2 months of the season, Judge has been a hitting machine.
Here's Judge, already with three hits today. And a bouncer through into left field. A four-hit afternoon for Aaron Judge. Bryce moves.
Following that game against the A's on May 11th, Judge was hitting 409. Since then, his average has dropped a bit, but he's still within striking distance of 400. But to do it for an entire season... In 1995, Ted Williams told the Classic Sports Network that would take nearly perfection.
In order to have that 400 year, which is a wonderful year, everything has to fall in place. You get cycles of good hitting, good pitching, you know. Everything has to fall in place. Good years, bad years, everything has to come in place.
After Williams, the man who came closest to hitting 400 in a full season was George Brett in 1980. The Kansas City Royals infielder batted 390. If he had had just five more hits, he would have reached 400. We contacted Brett to get his comments. He told us, it's too early. Call me in August. Aaron Judge is used to both the attention and deflecting questions about individual accomplishments, like breaking this barrier.
Try not to think about it. You know, I got a job to do on the field. You know, I got to make plays, score some runs for the team. You try not to get too hyped into that. That's for you guys to do, and I got a job to do on the field.
Last night, Aaron Judge had two more hits in a game against Cleveland.
Judge hits one through the right side for base hit.
Another step closer to 400, but the season still has four more months to go. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
Lately, 76-year-old Gerard Van de Werken has been hitting the gym.
I have a personal trainer, and, I'm doing cardio just to get the stamina in.
Van de Werken is a volunteer with Habitat for Humanity Austin, a nonprofit housing organization. He said he needs to get in shape for a blitz build. The organization will build 25 houses in 1 week, and Van de Werken wants to be a part of it.
I'm not so worried about how to build the house. It's just making sure that I'm physically strong enough to be out there leading the folks to help build this house.
This will not be his first home.
Well, I sort of semi-retired last year after 50 homes.
Every spring and fall for decades, Vandewerken has spent most Saturdays building homes. As part of our series, Here to Help, he described his commitment, starting with his first build on 13th Street in Austin.
They asked me to be the site leader. At that time, I didn't really have a team. And so 7 volunteers showed up and we formed a team. And for the last 25 years, we have built 50 homes. The first one, I had no clue what I was doing. And I still chuckle. There's one experience there. I'll say there's Gino, and we were sheetrocking, and none of us ever sheetrocked. So we were sheetrocking, and he had to cut that piece of sheetrock 7 times. We built community. We enjoyed each other, and we laughed at each other because we made so many mistakes. But we built a beautiful home.
Vandewerken says by the 10th house, the work became understandable and the learning curve was easier.
The one thing people understood about this team was if you came out to volunteer at our site and you're going to willing to give up your Saturday or your time, you're going to actually do something. And if you want to learn something, we'll teach that too. There was a young lady in one of the houses. She was sort of kind of hesitant. And so I went and asked her and says, have you ever done a ram set? And says, what is that? And says, well, this is this instrument that you shoot nails into the concrete to hold the walls up. But my boyfriend won't let me do any of this kind of work. That's not girly work. She started around 9 o'clock and we couldn't take that instrument out of her hand for the rest of the day. She was having a blast. And I heard her on the phone, not meaning to hear, but she says, don't you ever tell me I can't do anything. So my goal was, if you come out, I empower anybody to want to do anything. I was called a crier. Every dedication I speak and I shed tears because what most people didn't realize that I was an immigrant. I came to America many, many years ago. I was born in Jakarta, Indonesia. I'm basically Americanized, but to come to America at that time, there was a helping hand to get us here. And so I was very appreciative of that extending hand. So I was willing to give back. And so it just moves me to see that there are people in this world that understands that you can't get through life without a helping hand.
Gerard Vandewerken volunteers with the nonprofit housing organization Habitat for Humanity Austin. You can find more stories of volunteerism in America at npr.org/heretohelp.
Thanks for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. From Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. And from the John D. and